Hi there, this is Andy, and this is the eighth conversation I've had as part of my series, Quarantine Conversations in the Age of COVID-19. And today, I'm pleased to speak with a representative of the activist art group, In Decline, who are based in Nevada. Would you please introduce yourselves and tell anyone listening who doesn't know you what it is you do and a little bit more about your group?
Sure. In Decline's an activist art collective. We're actually kind of based all over, but we were created on the West Coast out in California in late 2001. The collective was originally comprised of graffiti writers and filmmakers and activists. And then as we've, you know, continued to work for the better part of 20 years, we've accrued, you know, dozens of other collaborators and co-conspirators, so to speak, that operate in all kinds of different mediums, whether it's, you know, sculpture, welding, we have poets, we have everybody. So it's just a massive collection of very active, very passionate individuals from all over the world.
Now, what are some of the more known things that you've done, whether they be art installations or protest pieces, that someone may have seen on the news, perhaps, that would have that you have done recently?
Recently, I would say one of the more notable ones would be the naked Trump statues. That was 2016, just ahead of the Republican National Convention. And then, you know, over the course of his first term, we've gone viral with a number of projects, both related to Trump and some policies that he's kind of ushered in, notably white supremacy. And so I would say the naked Trump statues, for sure. We glued the names of African-American men and women murdered by police on the Hollywood stars on Hollywood Boulevard years ago. We've got the world record for the largest piece of illegal graffiti. That's a pretty big one. But we stay pretty active. So there's quite a few stories, but I think the naked Trump statue is probably the one that most people interacted with at some point.
Is there anything that you've done, any piece or any something that you've staged that you're particularly proud of or that you were particularly worried about doing?
We're proud of all of our work. You know, on a personal level, I think one of the most monumental things we've done was a project called Death Metals, which was a piece we did out in the middle of nowhere on this, it's a Superfund site, highly toxic old gold mine that had been shut down, and just the land and the buildings and everything was just completely polluted and left to rot by the companies that were operating there. And we went out for, you know, the better part of a week and hid out, and we instead of painting murals on the existing structures, we took plasma cutters and saws, and we actually cut into the existing structures imagery related to man-made pollution and destruction and man's quest for wealth at the expense of the earth. And we illuminated them from the inside, almost like jack-o'-lanterns. And they're really large-scale pieces. They're still standing today. It's extremely difficult to see them because of the just the police and the security has been heightened since the project and since the press. But that one's that one's near and dear to our heart. And, you know, in terms of being worrisome, you know, everything we do is pretty brazen. So we spend a lot of time in the logistical planning phases, and we're pretty militaristic in that sense, where we don't, you know, we don't really rush in blindfolded to, you know, to some of the things that we might encounter while working. So we're pretty thorough, but, you know, I don't think we would do what we do, and I don't think we would be who we are unless we deliberately went out of our way to choose the projects that scared the shit out of us.
Of course. And have you ever, or has anyone in Decline decided that something might be too risky to do and you just scrap the whole project altogether?
Yeah, that happens quite often. You know, sometimes it's risky because of the obvious legalities, exposure, Sometimes it's risky because we don't feel like the general public will understand it the way we're trying to convey it. Sometimes it's a health risk. You know, death metals, Wheel of Misfortune was something we did in a toxic area. The landmines that were covering the runway that we painted, there's a lot of pieces that we've done that have been extremely dangerous. We've rappelled off massive abandoned buildings to paint messages before, and you know, you're just, you know, you're kind of dangling by some rope. And so we've pulled the plug on some of those projects where we just, you know, sometimes the wind's just not blowing the right way. And, you know, you just get this feeling that that night might not be the night to go out. And so, and I think it's a really important asset to a collective or any group to know when to say no to a project, you know, otherwise you'll use up your nine lives really fast.
Of course. And when you first started, was this something that was just a group of your friends that you wanted to do and you didn't really know how far you would take it? Or were you always wanting to do something that would be considered a little bit different as far as what you'd be doing, whether it's a career or with a lot of your time?
We became pretty radicalized in high school. You know, I think for the majority of us, when we finally came together and met, you know, everyone more or less had the same kind of trajectory towards using our privileges to, you know, go out and pull the rope the other way, so to speak. And, whether, you know, for some of us, it was encountering certain documentaries or certain literature. And for others, it was traveling and just encountering inequity and seeing the way the world works when you're young and impressionable, those kinds of things before adulthood just zaps you of your passions. And so we were lucky to get pretty fired up at a young age and not take ourselves very seriously. You know, Endocline's works very tongue in cheek. You know, we don't claim to have the answers to anything. We like to keep the conversation honest, but we also like to have fun. And so, you know, part of the objective with a lot of what we do is just to enjoy ourselves and, you know, and aside from bringing entertainment to people, also enlighten them, inspire them, create conversations. And so over the years, we've gotten just really good at that specifically. And dating back to, you know, the time before Indecline existed, all of us were complete delinquents. And we're, you know, so these things carried on from being extremely young, before there were cameras, before there were spray paint cans in our hands. Every single person that was a part of the Indecline family in the early 2000s was barely made it through high school, if we made it through it all. But we were extremely passionate and we were all artistic and creative. And we all had an inherent hatred for authority, whether it was through skateboarding or punk rock or a combination of all kinds of different cultural activities. And so, I think this was by no means a job. This isn't something that we make any money off of on a personal level. We recycle all the funds that we receive into the projects, so we can fund these activations. But it's a really, really nice way to move through life and feel like you're making a difference and have some fun while you're doing it.
Oh, sure. I mean, some people are in a band. Some people play sports, and you and your friends, your hobby or whatever your free time is devoted to what you'd call activations and making people think, which is definitely something interesting for sure. What did you feel when you started to hear about what was happening with the coronavirus? When I first heard it, I believe it was towards the end of last year in 2019, but I didn't really think much about it, and you know, you hear about it, you know, SARS and MERS and you know what have you, and you don't really hear much about it from there on in. But then all of a sudden, you know, like a steamroller, it was like hell-bent on whatever it is, hell-bent on coming to the United States and the rest of the world. But what were you and the rest of Indecline thinking about that?
You know, I think we were guilty, like a lot of people, of out of sight, out of mind practices with this one, just because, you know, it was something that for a while that was central to China. And we were traveling and working and kind of keeping an eye on it. But it seemed like, you know, every day we were talking about it more and more and more and more. And then it became inevitable that it was going to be something that we had to face here in America. We were actually out of the country when it became a serious threat and started to really kind of blow things out of proportion. And so that, I don't know, we've encountered a lot, you know, I mean, we've been through a lot of things, and I think this one was, it definitely felt like it was bigger than us. You know, you can have an election not go your way and know that for 4 years you can, you know, put your all into something. There's plenty of ways to change history on a daily basis as it pertains to a lot of the things we face as human beings. But this was just, it's bigger than us. And it's proven that it's just eviscerating our communities and our economies. And so, we were, I guess, anxious to get it started so we could figure out, you know, what the protocol was going to be, because, you know, as America likes to do, we sat on our ass and, you know, disregarded a lot of, and I say we, but I mean, our piece of shit commander in chief, but they, you know, they disregard a lot of information that was coming through well before the general public had access to it. And then by the time it lands on American soil, it's, you know, it's too late. And it's not that we could have stopped it from coming here, but we certainly could have done a better job containing it and getting in front of this. And so, yeah, it's pretty surreal. You know, I think for the rest of our lives, we'll, you know, I know a lot of Americans talk about 9/11, and, you know, every few years, someone will kind of ask me like where I was on 9/11, as if it's like this thing that, you know, kind of binds us, which I guess it is. But now it's going to be, you know, what did you do during the shutdown? And this is a global thing. You know, it's not like the world or you know, America is just on pause. The entire globe is being reset. So, you know, we're just taking it day by day and trying to be safe and creative in the process.
Yeah, I remember when it was 9/11, and I was in LA. I remember exactly where I was. And for a couple of days, there were no planes in the sky. There was really no one on the road. And then after a few days, the U.S. started to sort of reset itself. But you saw people out with American flags driving around all over the place for a couple of weeks, and then that stopped. But anyway, I guess my point is that was completely different, at least to me, in a lot of ways, because now this is really the whole world that is pretty much on pause. It's very different.
Yeah, it's an entirely different monster. You know, we don't have a grasp of when this is going to be fixed, and you know, and it isn't going to be a light switch. You're not just going to walk out your front door tomorrow and go resume life. Like, you know, we could do that after 9/11, after a very short period of time, with the exception of aviation and some civil liberties we unknowingly gave up. The restaurants were open, things were fine, you could go to a punk rock show that night with your friends. But this is, you know, this is a game changer on across so many different platforms. And so, you know, I guess we just have to wait and see. You know, it's just all about being patient.
Yeah, I know that here in Los Angeles, I think we're at a tipping point where they've started to open up the beaches in a way that you can go to the beach and you can look at the sand, but you can go surf, but you can't go swimming in the water and you can't sit on the beach. You can only walk kind of by it. And I think that personally, it really worries me, because I think people are just going to lose their minds. You get some rowdy people, and there, you know, could be a huge fight, rumble, whatever you want to call it. I don't know. But I always think the worst. I always plan for the worst in that sort of situation, because people are on the news and they're pissed off because they don't necessarily understand it. Now, you're in Nevada, right?
Yeah, Las Vegas.
In Vegas area. So your mayor was just on the news the other day, and she was either doing an act you know, and she was waiting for her second show that night, or I don't know what she was saying, but she was certainly saying some pretty interesting things on the news on CNN. And have you heard from any of your friends that are now have gone out to wherever you can go now that it has reopened in Las Vegas?
No, I don't personally know anybody that's going to any of the places that have been reopened since they started lifting the ban on certain businesses. It's not the time, you know. I think everyone still needs to just be a little more reasonable and patient and stop acting like, you know, not being able to get a haircut is the end of the world. I don't know. There's a lot of different ways of looking at this, and speaking on a personal level, I've flourished in the last couple of weeks just because, you know, myself and a lot of my friends, we're all decent and fine on our own. We're bookworms. We like to write. We like to scheme. We don't need to be out with a bunch of people all the time. We're pretty isolated. You know, I just think if you look at the amount of time that certain communities have been asked to stay put, it's really not that long when you look at it. It's amazing that we already have people showing up on in front of government buildings with assault rifles demanding that they get their hair cut. And so it's just it's embarrassing. And that's typical. And I'm kind of like you. I mean, I just typically wait for Florida to do something. Florida always seems to lead the charge in mental retardation when it comes to, you know, everything ever. And you see that throughout, and then it goes down into San Diego. So, you know, no state is I guess idiot free, but it's just really unfortunate that people can't see the writing on the wall and understand that without a vaccine and without, you know, everything we need in place to really kind of get in front of this thing, all you can really do is just stay put. And apparently we have a lack of creative citizens in America, because I feel like anybody that I know that has an ounce of creativity in their body is throwing their entire soul into this shutdown and making things happen for themselves. Even if it's just cooking, they're doing something.
Sure. Yeah.
So, it is what it is. And this is, you know, but at the same time, I think it's what makes America so incredible and such an awesome country to live in, because it's endless entertainment. I mean, every single day it's just a reality show. I slap my forehead probably, you know, every hour at some of the shit that I read. I don't mind it. You know, I stay here because it fuels my personal fire, and it just keeps me entertained and gives me a really solid monster to fight. And so it is what it is.
Where were you traveling from that you were coming back into the United States during the start of the actual shutdown?
We were in South America at the time. And so we got out of, I don't want to get too detailed about where we were, but we were, sure. We came back, I mean, right under the wire. It was probably less than a week. And the area that we were in was a complete shit show. And so, which isn't to say that coronavirus wasn't there while we were there, but in terms of their response to it, we were still able to go where we needed to go and do what we needed to do. And it was only a matter of days when we were back on U.S. soil that it became what it was. So we really snuck it in under at the last minute. It was close.
What do you miss most about not being quarantined or self-quarantined? I know that you had said that you and most of your friends can get through this pretty much without an issue, but is there anything that you miss doing that you're unable to do right now?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, not being able to, the first and foremost would be the ability to see my family. You know, it's really unfortunate. I have parents in their mid-60s, and you know, I wouldn't dare step foot in their house during this thing, on the off chance that something followed me in there. So there's that. And then maybe just from a creative standpoint, you know, while we really thrive on having hurdles and part of what we do, both in and outside of Indicline is kind of look for, you know, the path less traveled and try to find obstacles to overcome with our creative endeavors. It is kind of lame that every single thing that you're, that we're conceptualizing has this, weight on it now and all of these, not ramifications, but kind of just checkpoints, you know. You have to like, oh man, how many people is it going to take to do this? And, you know, how it's really difficult to go back into some of the normal activations that we would do when you, you know, you can't order things online and get it in time. You can't get, you know, a bunch of people together and that's the same place. You can't get on an airplane. You shouldn't, you know, you, it's tough. So, we find ourselves hitting dead ends and we're able to make some things happen, but, you know, it's a little annoying, but it's fine. Again, it's just, there's something comforting knowing that as fucked up as it is, the entire world is on pause. And I think psychologically speaking, what would be really difficult, would be a situation where the world is moving on without you and you're isolated, whether it's you personally, whether it's your city, whether it's your state, your country, whatever. I think the fact that everything is on hold has allowed us to be very calm and understanding. 2020 was a really monumental year for Indicline. There was projects that were planned that are very likely to get canceled as a result of this pandemic. And, rather than throw a shit fit and, you know, go blaming people and turn into depressed little petulant fucks, we just pivot and we make other things and, we figure it out. And so, I try to see both sides of this thing, but I'm not counting the days. I'm not sitting there talking about all the things I miss, because I think having spent time in jail, you know, the last thing you want to do in any kind of situation, is think about all the things you can't do. And so, you know, you tear through books and, you check in with your loved ones and you stay creative and healthy. That's what you do right now.
I agree with that. I think that, there is definitely a good, it's good to stay home and learn what you can learn and through reading or, yeah, I can't stream movies. It's so boring and that sort of thing. It's like it gets to you after a while. That part, the monotony of just watching things bugs the hell out of me. But I do like to read. That's always good. What are you reading right now, or would you recommend to someone who's looking for something different to read?
Yeah, recently we've been posting a lot of the books we've been reading. We did the, take you on a little field trip over to the bookshelf. Madness and Civilization by Michel Foucault. We're doing a lot of Chomsky. He's always a go-to. We just read a book about, a book of essays that he did about Palestine. Not a whole lot of fiction, to be honest. There's a book called The Fire and the Word that is about the Zapatista movement. There's a book called Imperial by William T. Volman that's pretty great. And then just some books that are related. We're doing a few projects, and so just some research books. A lot of Greek tragedies. We're doing a play at the end of the year, so we're just kind of brushing up and burning through a lot of those. And then we're working on actually a really cool international project. It's like a soccer themed sports. It's crazy. It's hard to explain. So we're just reading a bunch of books about soccer and activism and where those two things intersect.
Oh, that sounds interesting. And you're going to do that in Europe?
Yeah. We're going to do it all over. We've already started. We've been to a few different countries prior to the pandemic, and then right now we're talking about maybe going to Germany. We've been to Germany quite a bit in the last couple of months because we've had some traveling art shows out there. And so we'll probably try to do one out there and then possibly Colombia as well. So, I mean, as you know, soccer is just, it's a global religion. So, there's no place we can't go. Ironically, America is probably the least interesting place to do it, but we have plans of doing it in America. We just have a different spin that we're going to do.
And when you first started with your friends in high school, were you just doing things for fun, right? Like you weren't necessarily doing activism or art that you're doing now, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was, you know, you see the same timeline play out for a lot of kids, especially kids who grew up in suburbia. It's that boredom, and then you get destructive, and then you can either choose to just kind of be destructive, or at some point something, you know, hits you in the right place, and then you turn that destructiveness into articulating how you feel. And that's why a lot of punk bands are found or formed. That's why a lot of graffiti writers, you know, in addition to just destroying private property, decide to put other messages up in the process. A lot of it is just therapeutic. It's a release. And, you know, teenage angst is a real thing. But then, and so is confronting someone like Howard Zinn when you're in your teens and reading People's History of the United States of America. That, you know, that book has probably created more property damage and activism and anarchy than anything. Because if you read it when you're 16 or however old, it's, especially if you're still enrolled in fucking school, it's just, your whole world gets turned upside down. And so, yeah, we originally started off just wheat pasting and tagging and skating and just going out and doing our thing and having a good time, climbing billboards, changing the messages, and, you know, just putting really profane, immature crap and all over our neighborhoods. And then slowly but surely, we all individually or collectively came in touch with, you know, certain things, certain historical books or documentaries, or there wasn't a whole lot happening at that time. And this was pre 9/11 too. So it was just, I don't know, life just seemed kind of boring for a lot of us. And then once we hit our groove and once we got inspired enough to go out and articulate what we were trying to say, from like a social and a political standpoint, it gave us a second life. It really inspired us to make that, you know, a full-time job.
What was the what would you say would have been your inspiration to start this in general? Was it the music? Was it the punk music you were listening to at the time, or the skating, or were you learning about other artists or activists that were doing something along these lines? Or was it just something that one of you or you yourself decided that, hey, this sounds like it's a good idea, we should try this?
It was probably a combination of a lot of things, because within Decline, one of the things that really sets us apart is the fact that we document many of our actions, and we do it as cinematically as possible. And I think for anyone that's ever gone out and committed a crime, in terms of the kind of crimes we commit, you know how hard it is to do anything other than just do what you've got to do. So, you know, part of our approach is to be very immersive and take the viewer with us. So if we're scaling a building, or, you know, climbing a billboard, or hopping a train, or running away from the police in Mexico, or whatever the case may be, we always try to have a camera rolling so we can take you along for the ride. And that dates back again to being 11 years old, 12 years old, and stealing the, you know, your parents' camera to go film skateboard videos, and then always kind of being behind a camera, always behind, you know, a fence that you're not supposed to hop. And you start developing these stories and start documenting these adventures. And so it was really organic in the sense that all of the stuff that I did when I was 12, 13, 14, I still do to this day. I just do it for different reasons and I do it better. We were also encountering, you know, Ron English, like watching him in broad daylight just walk up in painter overalls and just wheat paste a really subversive billboard on the side of a building in front of a bunch of onlookers and walk away, and thinking how radical that approach was, because, you know, being as stupid as we were, you know, we're thinking you need to wait till 3 a.m. and then put on your ski mask and then and then go out into the cover of darkness when it's pretty much just you and the police, and we're watching, you know, this guy just lumber up to a billboard and know damn well that, you know, no one's going to want a confrontation. No, none of these civilians give a shit about that advertisement. And that, I mean, from a personal standpoint, I'll never forget sitting on a couch and watching a VHS tape of, I don't even know what the video was, but watching that single scene changed everything for us. And it's not to say that we still don't go out at night, a lot of things we have to, but that it definitely inspired us to look at the actions themselves as art form, and to spend a lot of time on the planning and the logistics and the research and everything that goes into it. You know, it's like a bank robbery. You're only going to be in there for a few minutes. That's the whole point. You know, there's a response time. And so when you look at doing anything, you know that you have to do it as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And the name of the game is to spend as much time as possible researching it and knowing that when you show up, it's a cakewalk. You know, you don't want to have any surprises. And so, those were really formative years for us, was watching Ron English and the Billboard Liberation and some of those guys do their thing.
Did you ever did your parents ever figure out that you had done something that they'd seen, or did they never figure it out? Such as like a billboard or something to that effect.
Yeah,
or was it always a private joke with you and your friends?
No, I mean, there's been some times where the news reaches friends and family before it's sent to them, you know? A lot of this was before social media. We were pretty late to the social media game. And so, way back at when we might do something, but we're not going to go home and just get on the phone and start calling everybody and telling them. So, typically what would happen is, yeah, your parents or your friends or your friend's parents would turn on the news and be like, huh, like someone hung this off a billboard over the freeway, you know, and then, you know, people who know. And yeah, at this point, our parents, you know, once a month we get sent some article and get blamed for something. And usually it's something we didn't do. But you know, it's at this point, it's kind of comical. Like the other day, some people threw body bags in front of one of Trump's hotels, and you know, as soon as it hit the news, there were 7 or 8 text messages that day that came through from people, you know, asking if we did it, just because as soon as they see this shit, they just assume it's us. And so that's not exactly a good thing, but it's also kind of funny when it's your mom and she's sitting in the living room trying to eat dinner and she realizes that, you know, the entire nation is talking about something that her son did. So we've learned how to pacify our parents over the years.
There was a guy here in LA. I don't remember if it was, I think it was before I moved out of LA initially, in the early 2000s, but he had changed. It was brilliant. There, you know, the freeway system here, especially downtown, is a nightmare and the signage sucks. And he went up, and I can't remember where he did it, but he went up and he added a very helpful direction on a street sign that made the traffic merge completely logical, and no one questioned it. He did it in broad daylight, and it was great. It stayed up there for a few days, and it was great. You know, that was one of the things that was like a win for the little guy, you know?
Yeah, sometimes it's those small things. There's one of my personal favorites was I think it was a gentleman in the UK was sick and tired of the potholes that were just all up and down his streets. The entire neighborhood was just plagued with these things, and the city wouldn't clean them up, or the city, they wouldn't fix them. They made no effort to fix them. The community was constantly complaining. And so he just went out one night with a can of spray paint and he spray painted big dicks in the street, over the tops of the potholes. And basically forced the city's hand, because it was like, well, if you're going to come clean these dicks up off the ground, you have to fucking clean these potholes. And they did. They fixed all the potholes. And so stuff like that is, I mean, that's just great. Anything that's subversive and immature. I mean, we all grew up with Monty Python, oddly enough. And so, you know, we're also very keen on kind of, you know, keeping things really sarcastic and irreverent at the same time.
Who would you say would be some of your influences, whether you mentioned Monty Python, musically or art, an art influence or just an activist influence that you felt that you really identified with?
I mean, I wouldn't whittle it down to a single band. I think just in terms of just growing up and listening to any politically active music, as a collection. And the same thing would go for books, just, and even movies and documentaries. I mean, just knowing that that's the genre, if there's a shelf in the record store or a friend that kind of leaned that way when you were a kid, all of that was, it spoke to us, and it, you know, it felt like the right thing at an age where you didn't really know who you were and what you were doing and what your purpose was. And, it was nice to see, you know, people doing things to stick up for other people, and using their platforms and using their craft, to speak out, and be active. Sometimes it's just music, sometimes it's more, but I, you know, from an art perspective, you know, definitely the films of Monty Python, definitely Billboard Liberation Front. Who else? The Yes Men later on were very inspirational. And also ACT UP, I believe is what they were called in the during the AIDS epidemic. They were a really, really intense group that wreaked havoc all over New York. And, I mean, they would take the ashes of their lovers and their family members that have died of AIDS and throw them on the lawn of the White House over the fence. They did some pretty hardcore shit. So, yeah, there's a decent list. But, you know, I think more than anything, it's just being able to travel and meet people and couple that with, you know, self-education and discipline. There's more than just sitting back and being like, oh, Banksy did that, and I think that's cool. I want to be Banksy. Everything kind of has a really good boiling point on like life's timeline. And I think for us, it was being a certain age, irregardless of the era, but being able to travel and coupling that with books and just like a really, really intense desire to learn about life and learn about how the world works. And the more you consume any of those things combined, the more it all starts to click and the more that empowers you to go do something about it. And there's nothing more empowering and fulfilling than walking away from an activation or even coming up with the idea. Sometimes that's orgasmic. You just being like, holy shit, that's what we're going to do. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you're driving away and you look over at what you did as you drive past it. You think, okay, that's going to be on the news in an hour. And then the next morning you're looking out your window for the police helicopters. I mean, all of that is just, it's an incredibly stressful way to live life sometimes, but you know, you're living life and it really breaks up the monotony. Everyone's got day jobs, but you know, it's nice to go out and play, you know, play Batman every once in a while.
I remember the first time I really knew who about your group was at Punk Rock Bowling when the Trump statue was beaten and beheaded on stage. That was pretty awesome. I mean, that was great. It was in front of a few thousand people and it was pretty fun to see. And it ended up, some of that footage ended up in Oi Polloi's Fuck Donald Trump video. I don't know if you have seen that. But it was great because I'm like, oh, cool, because I actually didn't record that or take a picture of it at the time. So now I can relive the moment. But it was great. And how did that come about?
We've been a sponsor of Punk Rock Bowling for years, and we were just kind of discussing what we were going to be doing that year with the Stearns and mentioned, you know, hey, we've got one of these statues laying around. We can, you know, if you want to do something with it. And I don't remember who made the judgment call on the beating. But yeah, eventually just, you know, we sent one of our production assistants to a sporting goods store to go buy a bunch of used baseball bats. And, wrapped the fucker up in a tarp, and it was game on. Mike kind of played the master ceremonies, Fat Mike, and I was, yeah, that didn't, that was surprising the way that turned out. It was pretty epic, to say the least, but, yeah, I still have the head sitting on my bookshelf from that night. So it's probably the one of the few mementos that I've kept over the years. And, it was an interesting evening for sure.
It was just the most random thing that I've seen at Punk Rock Bowling in quite some time that didn't really involve a band. Yeah. You know, it was a band there, but, you know, out comes this giant statue. I mean, how heavy was that thing?
They're not that heavy, actually. They're only about 60 pounds. You can lift it. You can lift it up on your own. I mean, it's really cumbersome because you got to get your hand around his belly. But yeah, you can completely lift it up. So it's just a bit of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, because it seemed heavier than it appears, I guess, because it took a long time for people to beat it to have any sort of effect on it. And then the next thing you know, his head goes flying off.
Yeah, it's a pretty strong coat of resin, and then inside it's just foam. You know, so once you kind of crack that outer shell, then you're good. You're just kind of hitting a bunch of foam.
Have you ever left these around, like to piss off like neighbors or someone you don't really like? You know, just to leave a Trump statue in their yard and run, or is that too easy?
No, I mean, these things take a lot of time and money to produce, and so when we've put them places, they're very. You know, they're valuable. They started selling at auctions for quite a bit of money after the initial run of them. So, you know, we're pretty careful about where they appear. And at the time, you know, we had a mold, so we were popping them out left and right, which is why we had the one that we let Fat Mike destroy. But, you know, nowadays, if you put it somewhere, it's like our little version of a Banksy piece. You know, if you can get your hands on it, you can get some money for it. So we tend to keep them under wraps for now.
What is your group looking forward to doing for the rest of this year? If you are able to do something in the public, or if not, then what are you looking forward to 2021?
Well, we have some stuff that we have a documentary that we've been working on, you could say, for 20 years. We've teamed up with some producers and a director friend of ours that did a great documentary called Saving Banksy. And right now we're in talks with a number of different production companies and networks about whether or not we want to make a doc or a series. And it's really just celebrating resistance art. And that was a really big to-do item for 2020. We wanted to release it ahead of the election. We have Shepard Fairey and the Yes Men and Ron English and a lot of people that we sat down and interviewed for that. So that was a big one. We've been writing a really cool satirical political play for the last year at this point that we wanted to stage in the fall. That's probably going to have to be revised. We have our first photo anthology, so 20 years of all of our photos being hopefully published and put into an awesome book. And then we have just like the existing projects that we've been working on and kind of honestly just holding off on because we just don't feel like the time is right to publish work while everyone's so wrapped up in this this pandemic. And so, you know, we're just kind of taking it week by week. And there's certain things that we're moving forward with as if nothing happened. And there's other things like the play that we're kind of continually meeting about and discussing in terms of like, okay, well, we should still finish it. We should still rehearse it, but are we just going to end up filming it and then releasing it online? Because we're seeing that Broadway has been doing that because we know Broadway is not going to be back on in 2020. So, it's just a little bit of juggling right now. We'll see.
Now, depending upon the outcome of the election this year, will you have material for whoever is the president after the election?
Well, we know it's going to come down to Biden and Trump. And I think what we're going to plan on doing is you know, putting everything we can into making sure that Trump is a one-term president. And then Biden gets to, you know, take the throne. And then as soon as he takes his first misstep, we'll be there. And that's kind of how we always, how we like to operate. You know, it's a checks and balances that we don't allow our government to, oversee. We do this from a public facing, platform. And so, you know, we have, obviously we'd rather see, Joe Biden in office than Donald Trump. But having said that, Joe Biden's also, you know, not the most alluring of options, but he's our option. So, from now until November, the name of the game is do what you can to get Donald Trump out of office. You know, I don't really subscribe to the idea that we need to be bitching about Joe Biden right now, as much as he's given us to bitch about and as deplorable as he might be. It's not worth looking back on the time we spent in 2020 realizing that we should have just sucked it up and gotten behind that old fucker and gotten him elected.
Right. Yeah.
So I get it, you know, I get it. But I don't understand where that sentiment is coming from when we know that all that truly needs to happen is Donald Trump needs to lose this election. So that's where we're at. If we do anything towards a candidate between now and November, it's going to be Donald Trump.
Totally agree. I couldn't agree with you more. Would you be able just to give people an idea of where they can find more information about Decline, and then any last thought you may have, and we'll be wrapped up. And I thank you for your time, by the way, as well. You know, it was awesome.
Yeah, you got it. So we have essentially two platforms. To keep it pretty simple, we're online at thisisindecline.com, and the website's three parts. It's really simple to navigate. We have a spot with all of our videos. We have a spot with all of our press, and then we have an awesome online store. And what's cool about it is we always joke about it and say it's like the Home Depot for anarchists. It's like spray paint, gloves, masks, you know, I mean, everything you would need to go out and cause trouble. But we have, you know, beanies and t-shirts and hoodies and socks and all kinds of apparel. But what we do is we take 100% of those proceeds and we recycle them into the actions that we're planning. And sometimes we're really specific about it. We might get on social media and say, hey, we want to do something about white nationalism. You know, for the next 2 weeks, every dollar you spend, we're going to put towards a project. And so the more we make, the more brazen we can get. And it's awesome because then we go do the project, it makes the news, and everyone feels like they played a part in it. We've done that a number of times. And we also have different shirts on the website that when you click on it, you'll see that there's organizations that we donate to, whether it's for, you know, immigrant support groups or reproductive rights groups in the South. So that's a really cool facet to what we do. And then we're on Instagram, and that's InDecline Official. And we spend most of our time there. We don't really fuck with Facebook, and we barely use Twitter. So it's pretty easy to find out what we're doing and keep track of the madness.
Awesome. And then any final thought for the listeners today?
Sure. I would just say that, you know, now's a really good time to work on yourself and to work on, you know, this is a reset for everybody. And so, you know, patience is the key. Don't count the days. And not that this is anything remotely close to being imprisoned or incarcerated, but there are similarities. And having been incarcerated and having been in quarantine, I can definitely say that my retention for knowledge and my mental acuity and the density of what I'm reading and the things that I'm studying, these are not things that would be happening to the extent that they are happening now if we were 6 months ago, you know, pre-pandemic. There are benefits to really shitty situations, and you have to be disciplined enough to exploit them. And so eating healthy, exercising, and really, really working on that brain muscle is a really good thing to be doing right now. And then just check in with your loved ones. And above all, just stay active and stay educated. Keep you know, keep tabs on what's happening. As soon as you tap out, you know, they get the best of you, and that's exactly what they want. We're constantly reminding people that, you know, saying that Donald Trump is too much to handle and, you know, vowing to never watch the news again is one of the most deplorable things you can do as a U.S. citizen. We have a lot of things at our disposal. We should be using these things. We're extremely privileged, and we should be using that privilege to make a difference. So now is not any time to lay low. Stay active. Quarantine! Quarantine!